Maribel houses friends and relatives. He promised to find a geologist who would talk to them as soon as possible. Though the man was one of the most energetic detectives Zoe had ever met, Foster was clearly running on fumes. His eyes were bloodshot, his shirt rumpled. She wondered if he remembered to eat and sleep. Zoe opened Harry's article on her laptop again. There were about 20 comments, and she read through them quickly. None of them seemed to be relevant. It was time to get to work. She shut the room's door and browsed her music library, finally deciding on Katy Perry's One of the Boys as her soundtrack. She needed a quick pick-me-up. No slow, instrumental bit to get the album started. Katy understood that sometimes. You just needed to get going. She'd printed out the whole crime scene report and spread the pages on the desk, her head bobbing with the beat, humming quietly to herself with the chorus. To-do-do, no fingerprints, no DNA outside the box. To-do-do-do-do-do, infrared camera in the box, same setup as the first time. To-do-do, box dimensions identical to first box. To-do-do-do-do-do, phone used is clean of fingerprints, screen cracked, probably from being thrown. She sorted through the images while Katy kissed a girl and liked it. Holding the panoramic view of the crime scene between thumb and forefinger, she frowned.
"Why did you dig here?"
she muttered. "What's so exciting about this place?" She glanced at the images of the first crime scene. It seemed similar. A lot of rocks, dry plants, uneven ground. The door to the meeting room opened. Foster stood in the doorway, frowning as he listened to the music. She glared at him, daring him to say anything about it.
"The geologist told us to drop by his home," he said. "We'll be going in about half an hour, if you want to join us."
"Cool, thanks." He began closing the door. "Foster," she called. "Hang on."
"Yeah?"
"Take a look at this." She held up the images.
"What do you see?"
He entered the room and took a look.
"The crime scene." She rolled her eyes.
"Imagine driving by this area, not knowing it's a crime scene. What would you think?" He shrugged.
"Nothing. It looks like everywhere around here. Dry. Hot."
"But it's not exactly the same." She opened Google Maps. "Look here." She clicked on a point in the map. The image of the area appeared on screen. A completely flat, sand-covered landscape. Hardly any plants, no rocks to speak of.
"Okay,"
he said.
"I don't follow your point. This isn't the crime scene."
"When you see those places, when you drive around San Angelo, what do you think?"
"I don't know. I don't pay attention. I grew up around here."
"But the killer does pay attention. Do you know what he thinks when he looks around?"
"No."
"He thinks, this looks like a good place to bury my next victim. Ari might think, this doesn't do it for me at all. This place is a turnoff. For him, choosing a place to dig is exciting. This is his pawn." Foster seemed distinctly uncomfortable. Zoe was used to that reaction. "Why is this?" She gestured at the rocky terrain with the plants. "A better turn on than this," she pointed at the sandy terrain. "Doesn't the sandy field look more fun to dig in?"
"I don't know, Bentley," he sighed. "Did you see that we have a definite time of death?"
"Really?" Zoe's interest was piqued.
"Yep. Curly estimates it to be between the 30th and 31st of July."
"That's remarkably accurate."
"Apparently there's an advantage to our killer burying the victims alive. He buries them deep. No insect activity, no exposure to heat. So Curly can nail the time of death quite precisely, just by checking the putrefaction of the internal organs. He really outdid himself this time."
"So, she died within a day or two of disappearing?" "It matches the same pattern as Medina. He doesn't waste any time. Takes the girl, and buries her alive almost immediately afterward." Foster nodded.
"What else?"
"We know he had this fantasy of burying women for a long time. He is obsessed with his own fame. He killed at least 3 victims."
"3?
Foster stared at her.
"We know of 2 victims. He even numbered them experiments 1 and 2.
"No, I told you. This whole thing with the infrared camera and posting the videos online, that's something he planned after killing his first victim. The original fantasy was just burying the victim alive. For a long time, it was just a fantasy. He probably never thought he'd go through with it. He dug some pits as a sort of make-believe. Maybe he buried some animals alive. Then came the stresses, causing him to snap. He killed his first victim, fulfilling his urge. Only then did he figure out he could film the victim inside the box. See how they struggle and die.
How do you know?
Because this is what I do. This is what these people are like. The original fantasy is never so elaborate. It definitely doesn't cater to external factors like fame. There's another victim, Foster. Call a victim zero if you need to. She wasn't filmed. And if we find her, we might even get fingerprints or DNA. He was probably less careful with the first one. Foster eyed her skeptically.
You talk like you already know everything about this guy.
Not everything. I still don't know why he chooses these locations. Chapter 55. The home office of Dr. Andrei Yermolov was barren and devoid of character. The desk clean and neat, the walls decorated with maps or diagrams of soil layers. Zoe sat on a chair taken from the kitchen, to the left of Foster and Tatum. While Foster explained what they were looking for, Andrei kept looking around him sadly, as if he constantly wondered how he'd ended up there.
So, he said, his accent heavy. You search for hidden holes.
Most likely covered with planks and sand, Foster repeated.
Andrei sighed and looked around him again. He eyed one of the posters with particular dismay.
Why don't you use...
He waved his hands vaguely.
Radar.
The radars didn't work when we tried it, Foster said. The technician said there was too much clay in the ground.
Too much clay.
Andrei seemed perplexed.
There is no clay in the hole. There is only a hole.
A second went by as they all considered this philosophical statement.
So you're saying,
Tatum said,
that if we're looking for actual holes, the radar will work just fine?
Of course.
Last time we were searching for a box that was buried deep in the soil,
Tatum told Zoe.
So presumably there was a lot of clay in the soil. But if the hole is just covered with a few inches of sand...
I got it, thanks, she said annoyed. No need to mansplain.
It'll be slow going, though, Foster said. I mean, that guy pushing the radar took forever.
Man pushing?
Andre's eyes widened.
Why don't you use a car?
What do you mean?
You hook the radar to a car. Drive.
He moved his hands, pantomiming driving.
The radar finds holes. It's easy. We do it every day.
Can you show us exactly how?
Tatum asked. Andrei sighed again and tapped at his keyboard, spitting short, impatient sentences as he explained. Zoe half-listened, already trying to think of the best way to approach this task. They'd have to focus on the areas that the killer had most likely dug in. It would have to be outside the city and not too far. But just searching in a certain perimeter around San Angelo could take weeks. They had to find a way to narrow it down. Her attention was snagged back to Andrei, who seemed to have stopped talking about the radar and now explained something in general.
Very hard. Tools break every day. It's frustrating. Research is stalling. The funding is almost gone.
He glared at one of the topographical maps and groaned.
I have a birthday next week.
Happy birthday,
Tatum said helpfully.
It is not happy.
Right.
Foster shifted his chair closer to the door, as if he intended to make a break for it.
I'm sorry your research about the Angelo bedrock layer is difficult.
Difficult? Pah! It is disastrous. Sample taking is terrible. 3 drills broken last week.
Why? Zoe asked. Foster tried to catch her eye, emphatically motioning for her to shut up, but Zoe ignored him. You said you're researching the Angelo stone. Is it called that because of San Angelo?
Of course. Do you see any other Angelo here?
And the ground is what, hard?
Hard? It is like steel. I need expensive drilling technology. I can't use cheap drills. This is no Minecraft.
What's Minecraft? Zoe asked. Everyone stared at her in astonishment.
Even I know what Minecraft is, Tatum said. And I don't have kids.
What's Minecraft? Zoe asked again, annoyed by her own ignorance.
It is stupid video game, Andre roared. Terrible. My son plays all day long. He thinks there is 10 kind of stones in the world. 10. I tell him no, it is much more complicated, but he tells me there is sand and rock and gravel and coal. To dig, he punches floor.
He actually needs to use a pickaxe, Foster said. There are all sorts of pickaxes and...
It is impossible to dig so fast with pickaxe.
Andre was apoplectic with rage.
He digs until he reaches lava. Absurd. And now he wants my help to get nether. Says I know about digging. He says I don't respect his hobby. Minecraft is no hobby. Stamp collecting is a hobby. Piano playing is a hobby. We argued yesterday all evening.
He switched to Russian, carrying on his tirade while specks of spittle shot from his mouth.
This is all your fault, Tatum mouthed at Zoe.
Once Andre paused for air, Zoe quickly interjected. So the ground around here is hard to dig in, right?
The Angelo series is.
But our guy digs holes, Zoe said.
Not in Angelo soil.
Andre let out a small, desperate laugh.
Trust me.
But he did.
Where? Show me on map.
He gestured at the topographical map on the wall. Zoe got up and pointed to the locations of the crime scenes. Here. And here.
It is not Angelo soil there. It is Tulia soil. Much better for digging. Look.
He turned to the computer and opened a browser. A diagram of several layers in different colors filled the screen.
This is Tulia. 5 layers, yes? Some hard, but not terrible. A lot of clay. Unpleasant, but you can dig. Now.
He opened a different window.
This is the Angelo series. You dig 12 inches, you reach this layer.
He stabbed his finger at the screen with vehemence.
The bane of my life, sukabliat. Thick and hard. The tools break all time.
That's why he chooses his locations the way he does, Zoe muttered excitedly. He digs where he can. Andre let out another short, angry laugh.
If only I was so lucky.
This Angelo series, where is it?
Everywhere. Almost everywhere on that side of map.
He motioned to the area east of San Angelo. And the rest? It's Tulia?
A lot of things. Some hard, some not.
But these two are Tulia, right? She pointed at the 2 crime scene locations.
Yes. Definitely Tulia. Can you tell us which areas are Tulia as well? And maybe other soil types that are easier to dig in?
Tatum asked.
It will take hours, no. Dr. Yermolov, Foster said. It will help save innocent lives.
Andre sighed.
Fine. Research is crap anyway. I go get coffee. This will be very long and... What's American word? Boring.
It was. The doctor painstakingly went over each area in the map, explaining about the various layers, tools that would be needed, while Foster compounded a list. Zoe listened, trying to take it all in. Though this was mind-numbing, she was sure the killer obsessed about these details. For him, researching the best areas to dig in was foreplay. Her phone blipped and she glanced at it. It was an email from Harry. She skimmed it. Her heart pounding hard.
You were right.
The digging killer wasn't partial to our unflattering article. But he didn't comment on the site. He sent me an email. Forwarded below. H. Dear H. Barry, I still remember my parents talking about Henry Lee Lucas's confessions. Everyone back then had a friend or a family member in the jury. We had a guest in town. Our very own serial killer. But he was just passing through. This time, it's the real thing. Back then, he claimed he killed thousands of people, and the reporters lapped it up, giving up their professionalism for a bit of sensation. Unlike Lucas, I will give no false claims, but I won't accept inaccuracies. 1. Nothing was inefficient in my methods. You were misinformed. Every step I took was necessary and unavoidable. 2. I do not enjoy the suffering of my subjects. I do what I must. There's a reason to all of this. 3. Any comparison of my work to anyone else's is absurd. If you had one page from Einstein's Annus Mirabilis, you couldn't compare it to another scientist's work, could you? Wait until you have the full story. And one more thing. The digging killer? I think you can do better than that. Schrodinger. With a few sentences, the killer had managed to shed endless light on his psyche. Despite his attempt at being cordial and warm, anger seethed underneath. They'd managed to rattle him. Now they had a line of communication. Chapter 56. Baltimore, Maryland. Friday, September 15th, 1999.
When she dropped his wedding ring, I thought I was going to scream,
Elise said as he walked her back to her dorm room. That would have been her fourth scream during the movie. He'd counted. Her screams made him think of his mother encountering a large cockroach. They grated on his nerves. Perhaps The Sixth Sense hadn't been the best choice for a date movie. Then again, after each scream, she'd buried her face in his chest, refusing to watch as the little boy faced the dead people trying to talk to him. She'd shivered in his arms. It had made him feel good, made him feel like a man. It was the second date, and unlike the first date, which had been a series of awkward silences glued together by small talk, it was going more or less well. He'd followed his roommate's suggestion and taken her to a movie, because the movie did the talking for you. And he'd been right. It was as if the movie provided the meat for the conversation. Before the movie had started, it was logistics. Which movie should we go to? Do you want popcorn? Do you want to sit in the front or the back? And after it ended, they could talk about the movie and its oh-so-surprising twist, which he had seen coming a mile away. For the past week, all people had talked about was the amazing, surprising twist, pretty much guaranteeing the twist would be neither amazing nor surprising.
What was your favorite part? Elise asked him.
He took a moment, not because he didn't know which part was his absolute favorite, but because he had to find an alternative.
The part in the end, he said dutifully. The twist.
The best part had been when they'd locked the kid in the small dark room. It had set his heart racing. But she might not understand. They reached her dorm, and she invited him inside for a little drink. He was tense when he followed her to the room. Unlike him, she had the entire room for herself. Her dorm was an apartment of 5 bedrooms, with 1 shared bathroom and kitchen. After he'd been smelling his roommate's socks for an entire week, it was paradise. She brought them 2 glasses and a bottle of cheap wine and poured each a large glass. The wine's taste lingered unpleasantly in his mouth, and he was dizzy in minutes. He hardly ever drank, hated the sensations that followed. But his roommate, an ever-flowing fountain of unsought-for advice, had told him it would help him loosen up. It was Elise that loosened up first, though, kissing him. She pushed herself on him in a needy and aggressive manner, her fingers scratching at his back, removing his shirt. He tried to be more active, to kiss her back, to caress her, to lead. But when he touched her waist, she grabbed his hand, moved it to her thigh. When he kissed her neck, she whispered that he should bite her. When he struggled with her bra, she lost her patience, removing it herself. Endless instructions and corrections. She took control. And the good feeling that had settled in him during the movie, when he'd felt like a man, dissipated. He was a kid again, getting lectured about how to eat politely, how to dress, how to talk when there was company, how to be a good boy. And despite the fact that usually he couldn't go an hour without getting an unwanted, potentially embarrassing erection, now there was nothing. He had a condom in his pocket, and Elise had another one she took out of her purse, but both were equally useless. She tried to help him, but that only made it worse. He could feel rage building up. It was her fault, not his. The way she pawed at him, the way she acted as if nothing he did was right. He could do her all night if she'd just stop nagging and interrupting his focus. He grabbed her wrist and squeezed it, pulling her hand away.
Hey, you're hurting me, she hissed.
He didn't let go, clenching his jaw, his heart throbbing, pulling at her hand, twisting it until she fell from the bed.
What the hell is your problem?
She half screamed at him. He knew that tone of voice. His mother used it often.
when she wanted to scream but knew people might hear them. Of course, it was still a dorm room with four other bedrooms and paper-thin walls. He didn't answer, just stared at her. Her eyes filled with tears. She wrapped herself with a towel. I'm going to wash up. You better get out of here. She stumbled out, leaving the door open although he was naked. He heard the bathroom door close. He put on his clothes, a steady ring in his ears. His mind was filled with violent images. He would follow her into the bathroom, grab her head, smash it against the wall. Then he'd show her he could function just fine. He'd use both condoms. But he also knew he wouldn't. No, he would leave and go home. And when his roommate asked him how the date went, he'd just say, "A gentleman never tells, har har." And perhaps if he was really careful, he could go through the rest of his college studies without running into Elise or any of her friends. He stepped out of the room, closing the door behind him. He was about to walk out of the dorm, but then he glanced at the bathroom door. He heard the noise of water running beyond it. A bunch of chairs stood in the shared kitchen, and he took one of them. He jammed it under the doorknob of the bathroom. He tried the handle softly, making sure it couldn't budge. Then he flicked off the bathroom light. Hey, Elise said from inside. I'm in here, hello? The sound of water stopped. He put his ear to the door, listening. He heard a thud and a grunt of pain as she ran into something. Then a slight rattle as she tried the doorknob. Hello? The door is stuck, hello? She spoke in a low voice. Four bedrooms. She wouldn't want to wake them all up, let them find her locked naked in the bathroom. Wouldn't that be humiliating? His rage ebbed as she tried the door again. Locked in a dark place. A good place to think. A good place to contemplate her behavior. Hello? Let me out! Alarm filled her voice now. She thumped at the door and raised her voice, calling for help again. Soon she was screaming, and her screams didn't grate on his nerves anymore. There was that erection after all. Chapter 57. As soon as they reached the station, they went straight to the Situation Room. Foster eyed the map on the wall. It was a large-scale map of San Angelo and the area around it, spanning about 10 miles in each direction.
Okay.
Foster handed Zoe and Tatum blue markers.
Let's mark the areas that Yermolov said were easier to dig in.
We should mark Tulia's soil in a different color, Zoe said. So far, the killer always focused on Tulia.
A different color, Foster muttered. You feds sure have fancy ideas.
He left the room and returned a minute later, clutching a bunch of markers in his hand.
Here.
He tossed a green marker over to Zoe. She caught it in her left hand, feeling ridiculously proud of herself, and tried to act as if she always caught things thrown at her, and it was no big thing.
Okay, Foster said. You have the list? I have it.
Tatum unfolded a page. It was a list of areas they'd composed from Dr. Yermolov's instructions. He took it to the nearby photocopier and copied it twice, handing one page to Zoe and one to Foster. Zoe located the cluster of Tulia locations. Each was a list of a pair of coordinates and a radius. She marked them on the map with her green marker. One area around the place where Nicole Medina was buried, another for Maribel Howe, and then additional areas all over the western part of the map. Foster and Tatum stood by her, crowding her, drawing circles of their own. Soon the entire map was filled with green and blue circles. We can narrow it further, at least for now, Zoe said. Both victims were buried less than 6 miles from town. I think we can focus on a 6-mile radius for the initial search. We can widen it later. Foster drew a squiggly circle on the map, using a bit of crime scene tape as an improvised drafting compass. It defined a 6-mile radius around San Angelo.
The pits the killer would dig will be nearby roads, but they'd be side roads,
Tatum said.
Also, he'd avoid any highly populated area. So we can ignore the area around Grape Creek, and we only need to mark the roads in the easy-to-dig soil.
They marked the relevant roads painstakingly one after the other. There was still a lot more that Zoe would have wanted, but searching that area with a ground-penetrating radar sounded doable. The work of a few days. Finally, all roads were marked. They stepped back, staring at the map.
I'm going to talk to Jensen, Foster said. Wrangle the budget for at least one radar from him. We need to start working on this as soon as possible. Maybe the FBI field office can give you a hand there,
Tatum said.
I'll check.
I need to talk to Harry, Zoe told them. She'd filled them in regarding the email from the killer in the car. Get another article ready.
I'll also ask Shelton if we can get anything on that email address,
Tatum said. Zoe nodded distractedly. It's a temporary email address. I doubt he'd ever use it again, but it's worth a try. Foster and Tatum left to make their phone calls, leaving Zoe alone in the room. She was exhausted. Opening her laptop, she read the email the killer had sent several more times. Then she got up and wrote three phrases on the whiteboard. Every step I took was necessary and unavoidable. There's a reason to all of this. Wait until you have the full story. She regarded the sentences, tapping her lips. Then she dialed Harry.
I was just about to call you, Harry said. Did you read it?
Yes, Zoe said. I have a few ideas.
I looked into this Henry Lee Lucas he mentions. I suppose you already know who that is.
He was a serial killer. No one knows exactly how many people he killed, but he was prolific. At one point, he claimed he killed 3,000 people, which is what the unsub is referring to.
Yeah, but do you know where he was tried?
Zoe frowned. Somewhere in Texas? He was caught by a Texas Ranger, if I'm not mistaken.
He was supposed to be tried in Austin, but due to pre-trial publicity, they moved the trial to San Angelo.
Zoe exhaled and read the email again. Everyone back then had a friend, a family member in the jury, she said.
Your serial killer was raised in San Angelo.
Harry sounded pleased with himself.
He's a local boy.
He mentions his parents talking about it, Zoe said. When was the trial?
It was 1984.
So, assuming he was between 5 and 10 years old, that'd mean he's now around 40, perhaps just a bit older?
Well, I assume he was between 5 and 10. What if he was 13?
Then he probably wouldn't say he remembers his parents talking about it. He'd say he remembers the kids in class talking about it. She recalled her own experience as a teenager, how the kids in school would talk about nothing else except the Maynard serial killer.
Good point.
And I know how to talk to him now, Zoe said. This guy has concocted a whole story about his mission. This comparison to Einstein's Annus Mirabilis. This is him telling us that he has a grand plan. A vocation. His email is full of it. This is what he wants to share.
And what will his vocation tell you?
Harry asked.
How will that help the profile?
Zoe snorted. I couldn't care less about his vocation. It's just a story he tells himself. But talking about it might get him to accidentally give us a real hint. Something we could use.
What do you mean, a story he tells himself?
People lie to themselves all the time, Harry. You should know it better than most. And this guy is telling himself one big elaborate lie to avoid seeing a very simple truth.
What truth?
That he gets off on burying women alive. Chapter 58. Zoe was reading a report about Henry Lee Lucas in the American Journal of Forensic Psychiatry when the door to the Situation Room was flung open. Lyons stood in the doorway, her face flushed. I have a suspect, she said out of breath. Zoe felt a jolt of excitement, almost as if it were an airborne virus, highly infectious. Who? She asked. His name is Alfred Shepard. He called the hotline.
When?
This morning. Lyons paced back and forth in the room, her face animated. This guy, Shepard, phoned an hour and a half ago. Said he remembered he saw someone who looked like Maribel Howe with a guy in the local pub. Zoe nodded, her attention rapt. They took some details from him. It turns out his van was one of the vehicles that drove through the roadblocks at 67 yesterday. It's a white Ford Transit. We figured it merited closer inspection. And guess what? I don't guess. He showed up twice at the Medina Memorial site. His face matches one of the people we photographed there. There it was. Too many coincidences to ignore. Zoe stood up, unable to stay still any longer. Do Nicole's parents know who he is? Not by name. I sent someone over with a picture to interview them. See if this guy looks familiar.
Is his story being verified?
Maribel Howe took a selfie in that pub with a friend, tagged a location, and posted it in her Instagram profile.
The photo was posted 3 days before she disappeared. It checks out, but anyone could have come up with it. Zoe nodded. Do you have enough for a search warrant? Looking into it. Maybe a professional opinion from me will sway a judge's mind. Couldn't hurt. Where is he now? We asked him to come over and tell us more about Maribel Howe and the guy she was with. He's in interview room one, as far as he knows. He's here to help us out. Anyone in there with him? No, I took a quick statement from him and then asked him to wait. He's been there for about 15 minutes now. Foster was just about to enter, but we thought we'd talk to you about how to proceed. You can watch the interrogation from the monitor room. Come on. Zoe followed Lyons down the hallway deeper into the station. The interior room was almost at the farthest side of the station, and that was not by chance. Anyone taken there would have to walk by the different departments, brushing past uniformed cops, detectives, detainees, closed doors with plaques like homicide and evidence storage and armory. Civilians who were unused to the scenery of a police station were set instantly on edge by it all, and nervous people made mistakes. The monitor room was small and dimly lit. Both left and right walls had large, darkened one-way mirrors in them, looking into the adjacent interrogation rooms. Detective Foster, Lieutenant Jensen, and Tatum were already there, looking through the left mirror at the man who sat in interview room one. He was bald and wore a white t-shirt and a pair of worn, stained jeans. His right foot tapped on the floor rapidly, his arms folded. He glanced at the mirror and then quickly looked away. How did he get here? Zoe asked without preamble. Did someone pick him up? Or did he drive over?
He drove over. The van's in the parking lot, Foster said. Someone's checking it out right now. Just from outside, I hope, Jensen said. We don't have cause to. Just looking through the van's windows and taking some pictures, Foster answered briskly.
He was impatient and didn't seem in the mood to coddle Jensen as he usually did.
Okay,
Jensen said, his voice clipped.
Was he Mirandized? No, he's not under arrest, Foster said. I don't want another mess like the one with the Whitfield case, detective. I want you to Mirandize him.
If you Mirandize him, he won't say a word, Zoe said. We can't let him know that he's under suspicion. Not at first. And you aren't required to Mirandize him yet, if he wasn't arrested. Jensen shook his head stubbornly.
He was taken through the police station into the interrogation room and left with the door closed for a long time. A skilled lawyer would argue that he felt as if he was being held. He came in his own van.
Foster raised his voice.
He can leave whenever he wants. If he says anything, that falls under spontaneous confession. Does he know he can leave? No, he doesn't. Don't make a big deal out of it. Just tell him it's something that you have to do before you start talking to him. Let Detective Lyons say it. Make it sound like a bureaucratic hassle.
Tell you what. Lyons laid a hand on Foster's shoulder, almost as if she held him back from punching the lieutenant. We don't Mirandize him until we're deep into the interview, and then we'll make the call. We won't make any outright accusations before Mirandizing him, okay? Jensen seemed to hesitate for a moment, then muttered.
That's acceptable.
Zoe looked through the one-way mirror at Shepard. We have to do this carefully. If he's our guy, he'll be ready for any obvious questions. We need to catch him off guard. Chapter 59.
Sorry to keep you waiting, Mr. Shepard. We had some things we needed to verify first.
Foster's voice buzzed from the speaker in the control panel. The sound system gave it a slight echo, which Tatum found distracting. He watched as Foster and Lyons sat in front of Alfred Shepard. Lyons had a laptop bag slung on her shoulder. Both had thick folders in their hands. Foster's folder was the actual crime case file, thickened with some extra pages. Lyons's folder was a fake.
It's okay, I'm sure you're very busy,
Shepard said. His voice was a bit gravelly, making Tatum think of a man who smoked. We really appreciate you doing this, Mr. Shepard, Lyons said. As you may have heard on the news, the investigation has a few concrete leads, and a testimony from you can really help us narrow down our suspect pool. Zoe leaned forward to the mic. Don't mention the news. We want him to feel like anything you tell him is classified. He doesn't want to know what's already in the news. Lyons blinked once in something that might have been affirmation, or maybe just a singular blink. Then she began outlining some of the case's details. She didn't say anything that wasn't publicly known, but she did a good job of making it seem as if she was disclosing it for the first time.
She's good,
Tatum said.
Can you please tell us about the night you saw Maribel Howe?
Foster put his folder on the table with a slight thump and pulled a small notebook and pen from his shirt pocket.
Sure, it was a few weeks ago, on the 26th of July. I went out with some friends. One of them just had a birthday, and I saw the woman. Maribel Howe.
Foster removed a large color photo from the folder and placed it on the table. It was an image of Maribel Howe in a park, a river in the background. She was smiling at the camera, the wind playing with a strand of her hair. It was a beautiful picture, and one of the sweetest images in her Instagram account.
Yeah, her. I saw her with a guy. He was about 6 feet tall, black hair, had a beard. I noticed them because they were arguing about something, and she looked kind of upset. I wanted to intervene, but my friend convinced me not to.
This is really very helpful, Mr. Shepard, Lyon said. We're trying to make a list of possible suspects, and currently we're focusing on a few in particular. Your description definitely matches one of our prime suspects, and it might be invaluable in building a case. This was an utter fabrication, but its impact was instantly visible as the man relaxed and smiled at the detective.
I'm really glad I can help. So tell us in your own words what you saw, Foster said. Well, they were sitting in a booth, but this guy was acting a bit aggressive. I couldn't hear what he said, but the woman, Maribel, seemed upset. Upset how exactly? I don't know. She seemed unhappy. Was there any other indication they were having an argument, aside from the way the guy talked? No. Like I said, I couldn't hear them, and they left soon after.
Try to nudge him a bit. Zoe spoke into the mic. See if you can get him to change his story.
Was he violent in any way?
Foster asked.
No. I mean, I would have intervened if he hit her. But he made no physical, intimidating gestures. No, I don't think he did.
Maybe he crowded her, invaded her personal space, Lyon suggested, sounding hopeful. Shepard seemed to pause for a second.
Now that you say so, yeah. He was kinda leaning forward in a sort of threatening way. That's part of the reason I wanted to intervene.
Was she simply upset, or did she cry? Lyons asked.
I don't know. I think she might have been crying when they left. It definitely looks like he's catering to what they want to hear,
Tatum said. Yeah, Zoe agreed. He won't say anything someone could lay to contradict, but he's willing to change his story to fit the mold. Lyons told Shepard again how useful everything he said was. As she spoke, she dropped the occasional tidbit about the case that they'd agreed beforehand to share with him. The man's attention was rapt. I'd say with your help, we have a good chance to catch the digging killer, Lyon said.
Good, I'm really glad, Shepard said.
He didn't flinch at the nickname,
Tatum said.
Maybe he got used to it,
Jensen suggested. Maybe, Zoe muttered. She watched the man intently as Foster spread the photos on the table. This guy isn't fazed by seeing pictures from the crime scene.
What does that mean?
Jensen asked. It means he's desensitized. But these days there's a lot of violence online. Anyone who's interested in violence can get it in vast quantities. Of course, it's one thing to see a random gory picture and another thing entirely to look at a picture of a decomposed body of someone you saw alive.
Is he the killer?
He's someone who's fascinated by this case, but that doesn't make him the killer. They talked some more. Foster dropped the digging killer nickname a few times more. Clothing now, Zoe said. Jensen nodded, grabbing the evidence bags from the table. He left the room, and a second later, the interview room door opened and he strode inside.
Detective Foster.
His voice was ridiculously mechanical, like a man who'd practiced his lines for hours.
The clothing.
A 5-year-old could see through that act,
Tatum muttered, frustrated. It doesn't matter, Zoe said. Look at Shepard. He didn't even notice. She was right. Shepard stared at the translucent bags intently. Inside them were the clothes Maribel Howe had been wearing when they'd found her.
Do these clothes look familiar?
Foster asked, spreading the bags on the interrogation room table.
Did she wear any of them when you saw her?
The shoes, I think.
Jensen hovered uncertain. Foster gave him a meaningful glance, and the lieutenant blinked and left the room. The interview room table was now a well-orchestrated scatter of photographs and evidence, and the effect seemed to be getting to Shepard. His right knee bounced even more nervously than before. Foster and Lyons took him through his testimony again, asking further questions about Maribel Howe. Had there been any friends with her? The night she'd disappeared, she'd been with some friends. Had he seen any of them in the pub? Foster got up, pacing around the room as they were asking the questions. When he sat down, he dragged his chair and sat to Shepard's right side. Since the table sat against the far wall, this had the effect of hemming Shepard in. If he wanted to leave now, he'd have to ask Foster to move.
I don't like that, Jensen muttered. The suspect looks trapped. A good lawyer could claim that by this point the suspect felt he was being held.
It's a completely standard interrogation technique, Tatum said casually. We use it all the time in the bureau. There. See how he's pointing out the pictures? We can just say he sat there to be closer to the witness.
Jensen didn't answer, but he seemed at least momentarily reassured. I want to show you some footage from the Digging Killers videos. Lyons unzipped the laptop bag.
Okay,
Shepard said. Tatum watched the man intently as Lyons opened her laptop and started the first video. Nicole Medina screaming for help. Shepard was clearly mesmerized. He stared at the screen, his mouth ajar.
He definitely looks excited by this clip,
Jensen said. They let the video play for several minutes. Shepard's eyes didn't budge from the screen. Do you know who that is? Lyons asked. He glanced at her, then back at the screen.
The other victim.
Had you seen this video before?
No, just images and articles.
She kept asking him questions about Nicole Medina. He was vague, his answer short. He didn't play dumb, didn't act as if he didn't know who that was. His eyes kept going back to the monitor.
I think this is our guy, Tatum said.
I don't know, Zoe muttered. I don't think his response fits.
Why not?
Tatum asked.
He looks almost excited by it. Isn't it what you were expecting?
The killer has the two videos at home, probably the full videos. I'm willing to bet he's watched them dozens of times. He probably has favorite segments. Does this guy look like he's watched the video dozens of times? Look at him. He's completely enthralled.
Maybe it's just really good stuff. Every time he watches it, it's as exciting as the first.
Zoe glanced at him, raising an eyebrow. If that was the case, he wouldn't need to kill more girls. This is the last reaction I would have expected from the killer. I thought he'd act as if he finds it abhorrent. Or maybe he'd watch a few seconds, cool and detached, but this? She shook her head. I don't know. A few minutes went by. Lyons let the video run. The sounds it emitted, accompanied by the mild echo of the monitor's room sound system, were getting on Tatum's nerves.
Okay, I think it's my turn.
He grabbed an earpiece and plugged it in his ear. He stepped out from the monitor room, blinking at the sudden harsh light outside. He took a moment to get used to it. He wouldn't be very imposing if he barged into the interrogation room blinking like a frog in a hailstorm. After a second, he pushed open the door to the interrogation room. The room smelled of sweat. This was something they couldn't have known in the monitor room. Shepard was sweating profusely. All eyes in the room went to Tatum.
Mr. Shepard, he said. I'm Agent Gray from the FBI. I'll join in for the rest of the session.
Okay, sure.
Tatum leaned against the wall and folded his arms. That was the extent of his job there, to stand by the door, blocking the way out, a federal agent, to make the pressure rise even further. Foster and Lyons resumed the questioning. Had Shepard ever seen Nicole Medina before? Had he seen her with the man who'd been with Maribel Howe? Was he sure? More photos were spread on the table, whose surface was hardly visible by now. Foster and Lyons were doing their job splendidly.
Mr. Shepard, Foster suddenly said, can you tell us where you were on August 12th at 8 p.m.?
This had been another of Zoe's ideas. The date was insignificant. None of the girls had disappeared on that date. As far as they knew, nothing had happened then. Zoe theorized, the killer would have prepared an alibi for the nights of the kidnappings, but he would be caught unprepared if asked about a different date. It would make him wonder what they had. It would unbalance him. And it did.
What? When? I don't see what that has to do with.
It ties into your testimony, Lyon said smoothly. To this guy you saw. So where were you?
I would have to check. Am I a suspect?
His eyes shifted, glancing at Tatum, then back at Lyons.
Of course not,
Lyon said. You're just here to help.
That's right.
Do you remember what you did that night? He looked around him frantically.
I don't like this,
Jensen's voice buzzed in Tatum's ear.
You're asking him direct questions. Foster, I want him Mirandized. I don't want another Whitfield incident.
No need. Zoe's voice sounded in the background. They're asking about an unrelated date. We agreed on it beforehand.
I think I was home,
Shepard said.
Can anyone corroborate that?
Foster asked.
A skilled lawyer could make the entire footage from this interrogation inadmissible.
Jensen sounded hysterical.
Foster, Mirandize him now.
You're being an idiot, Zoe snapped sharply. There's absolutely no need to act like a... The feed was cut as Jensen presumably removed his finger from the mic's button. Tatum cursed inwardly, realizing their mistake. When Tatum had entered the interrogation room, he'd increased the pressure on the suspect, but he'd also left Jensen alone with Zoe, and if there was something she absolutely couldn't do, it was handle someone like the lieutenant.
I think maybe I was alone. No, hang on.
Shepard licked his lips. In the background, Nicole Medina let out a long, desperate moan. His eyes shifted to the screen, then to Tatum. He seemed like a cornered animal. A cornered animal that was about to make a mistake. The door to the interrogation room flew open, and Jensen strode inside, brandishing a Miranda slip.
Mr. Shepard,
he piped.
Before you go any further, would you mind signing this? It's just a bit of bureaucracy. It states that you know your rights, that you have the right to an attorney, and that anything you say can be used against you in the court of law. You know, all that stuff from the movies.
He put the paper on the table, over Maribel Howe's picture, and smiled. Shepard's eyes went to the Miranda slip. He frowned.
Why would I need to sign this?
He asked.
I just came to help. It's really just procedure,
Jensen murmured. Every moment in the interrogation was a careful thread, weaving the web tighter around Alfred Shepard. Each subtle move tightened the trap, making it harder for him to get out safely. And Jensen had collapsed this carefully laid snare with one fumbling, heavy-handed move.
Am I under arrest?
Shepard asked. Foster sighed.
No, Mr. Shepard. You're just here to help. Well, then I think I gave you all that I can. It's getting late. I really need to go home now.
Chapter 60.
I was surprised to get your phone call,
Joseph told Zoe after they'd ordered dinner.
I thought you were back home with your sister by now.
They were sitting at the restaurant where they'd met for the first time. Zoe had ordered the same steak, and her stomach made a little rumble when she thought of it. I was delayed. I'll probably fly back on Tuesday.
Is she okay?
Andrea's fine. Zoe smiled, thinking of the message her sister had sent her an hour ago. Ever since Marvin had temporarily moved himself to the apartment, Andrea had begun sending her endless gifts of the two grumpy old men from the Muppets. Though she couldn't be sure, she got the sense that Andrea couldn't get enough of Marvin's company. The barman placed their drinks in front of them. Zoe had asked for Guinness. Joseph had ordered a pint of Shiner. Zoe took a swig of her beer, licking the froth from her upper lip, enjoying the heavy, creamy taste. She was glad Joseph had come. Though Tatum had wanted to get some takeout and keep talking about the case, Zoe needed a break. The bitter taste that followed her after Jensen had ruined their interrogation mingled with exhaustion that followed the constant attempts to guess the killer's motives. It was overwhelming. She wanted to talk to someone outside the case. So, how did you spend Friday evening? She asked.
Went to a movie with some friends,
he shrugged.
We had some laughs.
He told her about a girl who'd sat in the seat in front of him. She'd apparently kept overreacting to the movie scenes to the point where he'd been more invested in her reactions than in the movie itself. Zoe listened with a smile, her mind slipping in and out of focus, thinking of Andrea, of Schrodinger,
of Alfred Shepard. She was almost sure Shepard wasn't their guy. If she had to guess, she'd peg Shepard as a man obsessed with serial killers, who reacted to an actual killer hunting in a city. If Lyons received the search warrant, Zoe was willing to bet they'd find endless serial killer paraphernalia in his home. But she didn't think he was the killer. They put surveillance on him for now, just in case. She felt a fresh surge of anger at how effectively Jensen had managed to demolish their efforts.
What are you thinking about?
Joseph asked her. She looked around her. Half the tables were empty. The atmosphere seemed subdued. This place is a lot emptier tonight. Is it always like that on Saturday? Joseph raised an eyebrow.
I don't know if you've heard, but there's a serial killer on the loose.
Oh, right.
Any progress there?
We have some very good leads. It looks promising.
I read an interview you gave to the press,
Joseph said.
You sounded very sure of yourself.
We have a lot of experience finding these people, and in this case in particular, we have a bit of an advantage.
What advantage?
I'd rather not talk about. Her phone rang. She sent an apologetic look at Joseph and picked it up. It was Tatum.
I don't want to interfere with your date,
he said, giving the word date a strange inflection Zoe couldn't figure out.
But I got something for you.
What?
Shelton got a crew driving with a GPR running.
GPR?
The ground-penetrating radar. They already found one of this guy's pits.
She smacked her palm on the bar, eliciting several frowns from people around her. Where?
To the north, about half a mile north of Grape Creek, in one of the Tulia soil areas.
North of Grape Creek? She got up, mouthing, be right back to Joseph. How far from San Angelo?
5.5 miles.
Almost at the edge of our search area. She pushed open the door and walked outside. Despite the night's darkness, it was hot and dry. She was slowly getting used to the climate and didn't find it nearly as unbearable as she had the first day she landed. Do you think we should widen our perimeter?
We still have a lot of ground to cover,
Tatum said.
They stopped for the night, and it's the weekend, so I doubt we'll be able to get another GPR before Monday. I think we're good for now.
How does it look?
6 feet deep, rectangular, covered with 2 large boards, and about 15 inches of soil on top of them. It was a few yards away from the road, hidden from sight. About what you'd expect.
Did Foster get surveillance on it?
He's working on it now. Jensen's in a huff because we already added 1 surveillance tonight and it's the weekend. More overtime, I guess. Anyway, Lyons told me it'll be fine. They'll get the surveillance running even if they need to be there themselves.
This is fantastic news, Tatum.
I know.
She could hear the smile in his voice.
You can go back to your dinner now. I'll let you know if anything else happens.
Thanks. She hung up the phone, walking back past empty seats until she reached the bar. Their dishes had been served while Joseph was waiting.
Good news?
Joseph asked. Some progress on the case, she answered.
God, this smells fantastic. I'm starving.
She sliced a large bite of steak and put it in her mouth, shutting her eyes with pure joy. She chewed and swallowed, then smiled at Joseph. I'd never tell Andrea this, but the steak here is infinitely better than hers.
Welcome to Texas,
Joseph smiled at her.
I have to say, I don't recall ever seeing a woman enjoy food the way you do.
Maybe you were dating the wrong sort of women.
If I dated the right kind, I'd have a ring on my finger by now.
You want to get married?
Sure.
He gave her a look.
But no need to be alarmed, I'm not going to pop the question.
She let out a snort. Well, I'm leaving in 2 days, so I doubt you would anyway.
Don't underestimate me. Let me remind you I've chased women across the country before.
He burst out laughing.
Don't look so worried. I'm not going to stalk you back to your home.
A moment later, he seemed to realize his comment was a bit in poor taste, because he became deadly serious.
Sorry, I didn't mean...
Don't worry about it. Zoe shook her head, smiling. They ate a bit in silence. The place really was mostly empty. That would hamper the killer as well. She tried to imagine him right now. Was he outside his chosen target's house, like he had been with Maribel and Nicole, hoping she'd leave home soon? It might take weeks before that happened. Maybe they'd manage to catch him watching his target's house before he struck again. Or maybe he'd visit one of his pits and stumble into a stakeout. A sudden bright light snapped her out of her focus. A group of young men and women had clustered their heads together and were now snapping selfies of their night out. Zoe peered at them, biting her lower lip. What if she'd been wrong? What if the killer wasn't hiding by the victim's house, waiting for her to leave? Oh, shit, she muttered.
What is it?
Joseph asked. Lyons had said that Maribel Howe had an Instagram account she kept updating. Nicole Medina's mother had said her daughter was constantly on the phone chatting with her friends. Both victims had a prolific social media life. How had she missed it? Rummaging in her bag, she took out her phone again. She opened Maribel Howe's Instagram account. It was full of comments from mournful friends. The account was public. She then searched for Nicole's account, finding it easily. Public as well.
I missed something big in my profile, she said.
Nicole Medina had posted on her Instagram account the night she'd gone out to that party. She'd even tagged her location. Anyone who checked could know she was out with friends. All he'd have to do was drive to her home and wait for her to come back.
What did you miss?
Joseph asked. Zoe ignored him, going back to Maribel Howe's account. Yep, there she was, tagging herself outside the movie theater. The killer stalked his victims through their social media accounts, waiting for them to go out. Once they did, he'd drive to their home, wait for them to come back. When it was late, when everyone in the vicinity was already sleeping, when home was just a few steps away and their guard was down. The implication hit her hard. That meant the killer didn't necessarily have one target victim. He might be looking through dozens of accounts, hundreds, and he could check out their homes at leisure when he had free time, plan his hiding spot for the moment when he chose. Even now, with everyone scared, surely some of his designated victims might go out. She instantly had half a dozen ideas. They could do a bait operation, creating a profile for the kind of girls he targeted. She'd done something like it before. They could find accounts of girls at risk, warn them, monitor them. They could maybe get a list of accounts who'd visited Maribel and Nicole's pages and see if any of those visited a lot of other profiles. I have to go, she said. I'm sorry.
But you haven't even finished your steak.
Joseph looked dismayed. Right, she motioned to the barman. Can I take this to go, please?
Can I see you later this evening? I'm planning on going to sleep pretty late. You can call me whenever you want.
She looked at him for a long moment, the prospect alluring. Yeah, she finally said. I'll call you. Chapter 61. This had to be the shittiest birthday Juliet had ever had, and that included her 7th birthday with that horrendous party bear that had given her nightmares for weeks, and her 14th birthday, when Roger Asshat Harris had broken up with her. She always told herself to keep her expectations low for her birthdays. Low expectations mitigated disappointments. And yet even her lowest expectations weren't that depressing. Yesterday, she'd looked forward to a fun party. 9 of her friends had marked the event as coming and 5 more as maybe. She had called in advance to book the long table at Ronnie's, already imagining herself sitting in the middle while everyone sang happy birthday, a chocolate cake with a tiny sparkler in front of her. Low expectations, Juliet. Low expectations. Because apparently there was a serial killer in San Angelo, and he hadn't scheduled with Juliet before making himself known on her goddamn birthday. And those 5 maybes had quickly morphed into not attending, and the 9 coming had suddenly become maybe, followed by apologetic messages and cancellations. The final count of friends who showed up? 2. Tiffany and Luis. Tiffany's boyfriend. Luis, it was worth mentioning, was not even Juliet's friend. She thought he was a douche. But hey, he wasn't a coward. At least she was spared the